Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
The Vajra Chedeka Pranyaparamita Sutra, which is also known as the Kongo Kyo, or also known as the Diamond Sutra. And it begins thusly. Thus I have heard. At one time, the Buddha stayed in the grove of Jetta at Sravasti, together with 1,250 great bhikkhus, monks. When mealtime came, the world-honored one put on his cloak and, holding his bowl, entered the city where he begged for food. Having finished his begging, he came back to his own place and took his meal. When this was done, he put away his cloak and bowl, washed his feet, and spread his seat, the Nishidana, and he sat down. Then the venerable Subhuti, who was among the assembly, rose from his seat, bared his right shoulder, set his right knee on the ground, and respectfully, folding his hands, addressed the Buddha thus: "It is wonderful, world-honored one, that the Tathagata thinks so much of all the bodhisattvas and instructs them so well. World-honored one, in case good men and good women ever raise the desire for the supreme enlightenment, how would they abide in it? How would they keep their thoughts under control?" And the Buddha said, "Well said indeed, O Subhuti. In case good men and good women raise the desire for the supreme enlightenment, they should thus abide in it. They should thus keep their thoughts under control. All kinds of beings, such as the egg-born, the womb-born, the moisture-born, the miraculously born, those without form, those with form, those with consciousness, those without consciousness, those with no consciousness, those without no consciousness, they are all led by me to enter nirvana, the nirvana that leaves nothing behind, and to attain the final emancipation. Though thus beings, immeasurable, innumerable, and unlimited, are emancipated, there are, in reality, no beings that are ever emancipated. Why, Subhuti? If a bodhisattva retains the thought of the ego, of a person, of a being, or a soul, he is no more a bodhisattva." Now, bodhisattva is a combination of two words, bodhi meaning wisdom, and sattva is of high, fine frequency. And a bodhisattva is one who is next, his next step would make him a Buddha. This Subhuti bearing his right shoulder and kneeling on the ground on his right knee, they do that yet today. If you meet the Dalai Lama, his shoulder is always bared. And before he starts to talk or anything, he always goes down on his knee first. Always. I mean, this is, respect. difficult to obtain respect. Well, the sutras that are mostly read in the Zen sect are the Shingyo, which is called also the Panyaparamita, which we call the Hanyaharamita, which is the Japanese pronunciation. Huh? Panyaparamita is the Sanskrit. And they have the Kwanon Gyo, which is also known as the Prayer of the Bell. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that summer session. It's the prayer of the bell that brings the inner fusion of all the senses, you know, for enlightenment. And then there is this Kangyo Kyo, or the Vajra Chedeka, Anya Paramita Sutra, the Diamond Sutra. And the what I read to you is an English translation of a Chinese version that was written by Kumarajiva back in around 400 CE, Christian era. Yeah. Now, all persons, all individuals seeking enlightenment must remember that all literature about and all talking about is only a finger pointing. An earnest seeker, one who's really serious about this business, you know, that here and there, one or two, he must hold to the idea that he must grasp the naked truth with what they call an ungloved hand. And this is possible only with a consciousness that has been opened from within. And of course, it opens only with a great deal of effort. When the consciousness is open, then you know what an ungloved hand is with which you grasp the truth of enlightenment. Huh? Now, literature, of course, is helpful. Talks now and then are helpful. After all, they do point to a way. They indicate something. Huh? But it is never the thing in itself. Now, in Buddhism and in Zen, there is a great deal of talk, and there is some things written about shunyata, or emptiness. And there are those who are of the opinion that this so-called philosophy of shunyata, the philosophy of emptiness, is the foundation of Zen itself. And so they study this emptiness. And they have all kinds of erroneous ideas about emptiness because they do not take into consideration that first comes the experience. Then the ideas about, then the thinking about, then the philosophy about. First the experience. The metaphysical jargon and ideas and the psychological views about may be presented after the Zen experience takes place, not before. So we could say now the philosophies of the sutras, whatever philosophy you find in the sutras, never precede the experience. They follow. Now this the great Nagarjuna, you know, who espoused this emptiness to such a great extent, the emptiness of the middle way. Without his experience of enlightenment, he could never hope to write a single word about the shunyata or any panya philosophy. As we know we have heard that this Nagarjuna, you know, he was one of the Buddhist patriarchs. He was one of the greatest. And it is out of his presentation of his experience comes the great school of the Avatamsaka. And those of you who in this country have read Korzybski and his abstracting process, they say he's like a third grader compared to what is to be known and can be known through this Avatamsaka. And the Avatamsaka, of course, there are koan about it, so that all Zen monks do observe something of it. But Henry tells me there are about 5 people in the world who really truly understand the Avatamsaka. So there are a lot of things to know sitting there on your desk. The Buddha, you know, as he taught his monks and his nuns, he never compromised in his teachings. Truth, he said, has to be said as it is. And if you don't say that, you shut up. The moment that one compromises with the teachings, it loses its soul. It becomes superficial. And he felt that human beings, we being human beings, in a manner of speaking, we have to be led to a level of truth which transcends empirical truth, thinking. Every day we deal with empirical facts, ordinary facts, scientific facts. But transcending these facts, there is the law. He called it the Dharma. The Dharma transcends the Dharmas. And this was Buddha's great work. 25 centuries ago, 2,500 years ago, one day, early in the morning, this sutra was born. 1,250 monks were present in this city of Pravasti. And as I understand it, it was a great city in its day. And the word itself, Pravasti, means city of glory. And in ancient India, it was one of the glorious cities. I understand that today it's a very, very small little village. It's so small they don't even put it on the map. And I understand it is now called Sahet Mehet. No longer Shravasti, So life, things go on changing. Big city becomes little city becomes big city. Cities become cemeteries become cities. Yep. Ever-changing flux and flow. Ever-changing. Life is ever-changing. Don't sit in the middle of this. You move with it. Move. Now, the Buddha taught for 49 years, and of those 49 years, he spent in this city of Pravasti. That's how much he loved it. 25 of those, half of his life, of teaching life. And most of the sutras of the Buddha were born in that place. Now, the Vajra Chedeka, or the Diamond Sutra, we call it, It means the perfection of wisdom, which cuts like a thunderbolt. You got the Vajra in it, you know. The thunderbolt. When this thunderbolt cuts, you know, when it, you know, there is this experience, and then it is, there is a remainder, ashes of oneself, what you were. And out of, like the phoenix, you know, that then now that rises out of the ashes of itself, the new is born. And this is what Jesus had reference to when he was talking to Nicodemus. You know, when Nicodemus came asking, what should I do so that I can enter the kingdom of God? And Jesus said to him, you must be born again. You must be born of water and of spirit. Unless you die, so you can be reborn, you cannot enter the kingdom. The thunderbolt has to come. The ashes have to be there, and then this essence, you rise again. Because the ego must be reduced to these ashes, you know, for the essential to surface. But in this one stroke, wisdom removes the ego. And we sit here so that this wisdom can emerge. Present it is in every one of you. You are very wise. You just don't know it. Wisdom is present, you know. Allow it to emerge. This is a very great sermon from the Buddha, this sutra. You know, we really should get in tune with it. Now, the teachings that the Buddha gave, we call non-repressive and non-ideological. And that's very rare. Ordinary kind of teaching, you know, the garden variety, is somewhat, to be generous, somewhat repressive. And I think we all know when something is repressive, it does not liberate. It oppresses. And if we look around in our Western culture at some of the literature that has been handed down to us through the years, I think we begin to wonder. And we find, such as in The Imitation of Christ, words to the effect, words, I quote, the more violence you do to yourself, the greater will be your growth in grace. There is no other way save daily mortification. To despise oneself is the best and most perfect counsel. Great. There are a lot of people that agree with Thomas A. Kempis. He was, for those of you who might be curious, he was a monk in the Netherlands, and he could write, and he could copy proficiently. Whether or not he really authored this Imitation of Christ, nobody's really sure. It may be, some people think, that he just copied it, you know, in the Latin from the Dutch and put his own interpolations in it so there would be an official Latin version. And he died in 1471. Then there is a man, also very highly regarded in the Western culture, and his name was Bossuet. He died in 1704, and he was known as one of the greatest orators in French history. And he was a bishop, and as a bishop, he wrote a treatise called The Treatise of the Knowledge of God and Oneself. He was a great moralist. He was a very controversial person, and he very brilliantly attacked the Jesuits, the Protestants, and the Quietists. What did he write? Cursed be the earth. Huh? Cursed be the earth. 1,000 times cursed be the earth. You like that? Yeah. And it makes you ask, why? Why curse the earth, huh? Why should the earth be cursed? It's like saying, well, God is against life, because here's all this existence, this life. Huh? And it's then as if life is against God. But life is God. You know, there's no antagonism. There's God, life, and the earth. That's all one reality. What are you going to curse? Yeah. And then there was also a long, long time ago in the church a group of men, and they called themselves the Ignorantine Friars. Mm-hmm. Ignorantine Friars. The thinking mind leads you astray. So the more stupid you can keep yourself, the more ignorant, the better off you are. They would not accept anyone who could read or could write. Actually, they actually went after this thing. The more stupid that you could make yourself, the better off you were. You're going to be chairman? Friars? Yeah. Anyway, you see, when people get ideals, now in this case, stupidity was an ideal. And maybe a lot of people have it as an ideal and don't know it. But ideals do such strange things to us. And we don't even seem to know it. That's how unaware we are. Now, this man, Gautama Siddhartha, didn't believe in ideals. He said they create tension and they create conflict. After all, you have your ideal and I have my ideal, and what are we going to do? We're going to fight about it, of course. Ideals divide people. Ideals divide the person, and they create a lot of anguish. Because, you know, you look at one ideal and you would like to be it. At the same time, you're something else. And here you are, stretched between what you are and your ideal. How in the world are you ever going to find any happiness or any peace? How even can you be silent? How can you find any stillness? You can't be still if you're living in tension and in conflict and in confusion. And here is this big problem. Should you follow your ideal or should you look at reality? Looking at reality, of course, is looking at yourself. And if you are in this idealistic thing, well, how are you going to trust yourself? How can you learn to stand on your own 2 feet if you're chasing an ideal and not able to trust yourself? You know, as Lao Tzu said it, man on tiptoe is not steady. No. Well, that's, you know, my ideal. Anyway, the Buddha's way is non-ideological, non-repressive. He didn't talk about God. He didn't talk about heaven. He doesn't give you anything to hold to. He just takes it away. He even, you know, took away the idea of self, of an I, of an ego. He said, Anatta, you're not a self. And when all that's taken away, what does it leave? Well, some people say that's emptiness. This term is very difficult. Very difficult to understand emptiness. Remember, always remember that it is a word, and a word is nothing but a symbol. A word is something that points to. The word is never the thing itself. I don't care how many menus you look at, you're never ever going to be filled from looking at menus. It's the same with words. The emptiness that we think of as emptiness exists only in your head. So what then is this shunyata, emptiness? To take away, as the Buddha did, is the greatest giving. However, have you ever noticed in our language how much we take? Listen, we don't have this kind of giving. You know, we talk about, I take an exam. Man talks about, I take a wife, or I take the wife, mom. You know? And a woman says, I take the husband. Right, you know, blah, 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 there and there. I take a nap, which you can never do. You have to let go, you know, you have to surrender, otherwise sleep would never come. You can't take a nap. This is our crazy language, huh? So even in our whole language, it shows we don't know how to let go. We don't know what we're doing half of the time. The Buddha takes away differently. We take to add on. He takes so you'll let go. And he takes away the past, and he takes away God, and he takes away the future. And finally, he takes away this last thing that is very difficult for us to give. Oh boy, is it difficult. He takes away yourself. And he leaves then a pure, innocent, virgin emptiness. And that virgin emptiness he called nirvana. Yeah. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. This is the Song of Meditation by Hak Win, who is your great, 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 great grandfather in the teaching. From the very beginning, this is what you are. So what have you done with it? What are you doing with it now that you know better? We have accumulated so that the emptiness is no longer discernible, but it's there. It's like in our house, you know. We go on accumulating knickknacks and furniture and magazines. And, well, just come and look at my house, huh? Until there's no longer any space. And then the day comes when we can't even, you know, we can't even move around the house because there's so much furniture. Yeah. You see, there's a thing, though. The space hasn't gone anywhere. Maybe that's what I can't cope with. You remove all the furniture, and there's the space. It's hidden by the furniture, but the furniture didn't destroy it. No more than your thoughts destroy what you are. They only lead you astray. But the Buddha nature of yourself has not been destroyed. The emptiness of yourself has not been destroyed. Your inner emptiness, your nirvana, is sitting there. You're sitting on it? Or what? What are you doing with it? So the Buddha teaches how to live without any goal. Not to be such an achiever. Huh? That he wasn't so much interested in. Of course, those times, 2,500 years ago, living was different than it is now. But you don't have to go out and achieve to live. To live, what you need is peace now. To be at peace now is what he was saying. How to live in awareness. Now, this awareness is not a means to anything. It is the end in itself. It is both a means and an end. So awareness has a value that's intrinsic. And it is the most valuable thing about you. So would you please pay a little attention to it? Yeah. Now, the Buddha also didn't teach any other worldliness. You know, people, you know how we are? We're very worldly. The other world is not very otherworldly either, because we have made it an improved model of this world. If you're going to create another world, on what do you have to base a new world on? As a human being? You can improve and you can decorate, you can remove a few things and you can replace, so that the new world is not very different than the old one. It can't be. We're human beings. It's just simply the other world now is just a continuity. It comes out of your mind. There will be beautiful women there. The Muslims have done with it. 1,000 beautiful houris you're going to have. I don't know where they're all going to come from. I mean, unless we're all very beautified when we go to Muslim heaven or something. And maybe I don't want to be a houri. 1,000 beautiful women you will have. You know, there are beautiful women here, but the women there, 10 times more beautiful. Oh, yeah. You're going to have the same kinds of pleasures. More permanent, more stable, but the same. Food will be more tasty, but food. And you will have houses, but they will be made of gold. But there'll still be houses. You're simply repeating the whole thing. This world projected into the future. There'll be no misery and no poverty and no illness. No. Things you don't like here, you're going to leave here. They're not going to be there. And the things you like will be there in great abundance. How about that? That's the kind of an ideal we make. And look how many people are trying to get into this kind of a heaven and saying they have been reborn. You don't have to create a future world. Your future world is sitting in you now. We don't have to lie to ourselves. And we don't have to hide from ourselves. Just be here in this world, be here alert. Be here conscious. Be here mindful. If you want to be more than, then be more conscious. consciousness implies beingness. Consciousness implies being. When somebody is drunk, or when they're stoned on drugs, one loses being. When you're fast asleep, where are you? When you're very alert, sometimes you really get together with yourself and you can putz down the street good, and it's boy, top of the morning and it's marvelous and you got energy and, you're going, you're alert. You notice things you never noticed before. See, there's a whole different quality about you. And you feel rooted this way. You feel that there is a solidity of yourself. And the solidity is quite tangible. And the rest of the time, when you slip from that solidity, you just drag by like a zombie. Yeah. So Buddha's message really is, be conscious. For no reason except to be conscious. Be conscious where there is no I present. Just be conscious. Where there is no idea of self. Just be conscious. And that, is unbounded. It's immeasurable. Consciousness, as soon as the I is out of it. And do you know that this is what Buddha called meditation? Right meditation? Samasamadhi, he called it. There are teachers I know that call it silly samadhi. Samasamadhi. Consciousness with no I. Alone. Right meditation. To be so utterly alone that you are one with all of it. Right meditation and wrong meditation. If you are doing the meditation, it's wrong. It's not correct. If there is no I there, if there is no meditator, then it's right meditation. And if you persist, and if you pursue this path of meditation, you will come upon this. You will come upon it sooner or later. I promise you. Now, as I have explained before, so all of you know that Ananda was the Buddha's attendant, and he took care of him all so many years. And Ananda had this wonderful memory. I've told you all this before, so I'll tell you again. Maybe somebody didn't hear it. Ananda remembered everything that was said, everything that the Buddha said. And so all the sutras begin with, thus have I heard, or thus I have heard. He didn't say, Buddha said so-and-so, or such-and-such. No, he's just inferring that he was present, that he was a witness. I can relate what I heard, but what the Buddha said, only he knows. What he meant by what he said, he knows. I was only present. I'm just telling you what was said, not interpreting anything. All I can remember is what I heard. He didn't put himself into it at all. So this primitive Buddhism from Ananda that the Buddha said, is quite nice. Thus have I heard. At one time, the Lord dwelt at Stravasti. This is a different interpretation. Early in the morning, the Lord dressed, put on his cloak, took his bowl, and entered the great city to collect alms. When he had eaten and returned from his rounds, The Lord put away his bowl, washed his feet, and sat down on the seat arranged for him, crossing his legs, holding his body upright, and mindfully fixing his attention in front of him. I would have liked to have been there. Yeah. You know, when these sutras were translated into Western language, the people who did the translating were very puzzled. Why so much repetition? There's a tremendous amount of repetition in these sutras. Why are all these small things related? He washed the bowl and he sat down and, you know, why didn't they just say he was there and he gave a talk? No. What Ananda was trying to convey is that the Buddha paid a great deal of attention to everything, small things. To the small as much as to the big thing. See? Nothing small, nothing big. Everything was important. He was mindful of everything. When he takes his bowl, he is respectful. When he puts on his cloak, he is mindful. You know, he's not mechanical. His mind is not moving in 1,000 directions. We take a shower or a bath, we take it in disrespect. We dress in disrespect. You're not there. Your mind is in 10,000 other places. You eat, but you're disrespectful to the food that is nourishing you. You're not there. Doing things just habitually and mechanically. And when a Buddha does a thing, he is totally, utterly present. He is nowhere else. Consciously here. I would think to watch such a one, just to watch, would be a tremendous blessing. Yeah, how he walks, how he eats, how he makes gestures, how he looks at you. Each moment he looks, each moment is a moment of truth. Each moment is a moment of awareness. There's such dignity in it, you know. And when he came and sat down, there must have been this tremendous silence. You know, here he is with his mind fixed, you know, and all these monks sitting there. He arranged his dress, and he washed his feet, and he sat upon the seat, and he sat upright, and then focused his attention. Fixing your attention in front of yourself is called Anapanasati Yoga. Mindful. This is something that this word Anapanasati is something that the Soto Zen people use a great deal. Mindful of breath coming in. Mindful of breath going out. Attentive. Right here in front of you. Even attentive while asleep. Now the monks, you know, in the monasteries, they're trained. They lie down and they're supposed to be in this one position all night long on their backs. So that they're mindful even when they sleep. It is told of Ananda that he had a great curiosity about the Buddha. After he'd been with him for about 10 years, he used to come in and check him during the night. And he found that wherever Buddha put his hand when he went to sleep, here's where it stayed the whole night. Same posture all night long. You go to sleep on your back, mindful of it. Yeah. So Ananda, however, was very curious. So one day he asked the Buddha, he says, I know it's not right for me to get up in the night and keep looking at you. But I'm very curious about you, and I'm puzzled. You remain in the same position, the same posture all night. Do you sleep? Or do you continue your awareness? And the Buddha answered, sleep happens to the body. I remain alert. The body is relaxed, but the awareness is bright. Meditation is a 24-hour thing. You don't just do it once a day and call it finished, or do it once a week and say, this is neat. Meditation, if you do it continuously, becomes, I'm going to use a word, it becomes your flavor. You know, it's like 31 flavors, ice cream, lots of flavors, huh? And we have flavor to us. We call some people sweet, and we call some people sour, and we call some people droll. The flavor of meditation, of a continual practice, you know, it flavors your life and it spreads out into the people that are around you. You don't have to tell them you do anything. They will come and ask, you know. So let meditation be your climate, your atmosphere. Let it surround you. Wherever you are, whatever you do is flavored by this meditation. Then the many monks approached to where the Lord was, saluted his feet with their heads, that is, bowing, you know, and thrice walked around him to the right and sat down on one side. Now, to question one such as a Buddha, it takes a certain attitude. How you ask? In what mood do you ask? What is your attitude in asking? Are you receptive? Or are you just blah, blah, blah? Are you just curious? From whence cometh your question? Why do you need an answer? Are you ready to receive the gift if it is given to you? Will you welcome it? Will you take it into your heart? Will you allow it to become a seed? It needs a certain quality so that you can benefit from a question. Now, walking around him three times is symbolic, of course. And we have this in this, the symbol of the Aya, the triune self, three bodies. First time around for the physical, that's the one, the sense body, huh? Without the senses, we wouldn't learn very much. We could journey. Without the senses, we could be in the group of friars who wanted to be ignorant, huh? Without senses, you wouldn't be here. The second round is for the body of bliss, which is called Sambhogyakaya. And the third round is for the Buddha body, the truth body, the Dharmakaya. Yep. Also, we could say that the walking around, the three rounds, you know, are symbolic of the three shelters, you know, or refuge. You know, I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. And that's how we bow. You make it three times before you know, the last one is in there. We bow. You will be instructed again next week as to how to bow, because some of you are not doing it very well. We bow three times. One time taking refuge in the Buddha. It's the Buddha nature, huh? To shelter yourself in. And then you bow again to take refuge or shelter in the Dharma, in the law. Huh? And then you do once more for shelter in the Sangha, which is commonly known as the community. But Sangha is more than that. It is also the harmonious whole. There is a harmony to a Sangha. Or we could say, too, the first bow is for the Buddha present. The third bow is for all the Buddhas, past and future. And for that, we need a commune, a Sangha, in between. Between the Buddha and the Sangha, there is the art of awakening, the law of awakening, which is the Dharma. So you bow with respect. And we should learn a little respect. Okay. And now, may the peace and the power that passes all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.